From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. State of Belief airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it today. And now more than ever, we need you to join our other generous listeners who make this show possible. For information on making a tax-deductible donation, please visit stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. I want to extend my sincere condolences to the families shattered by the latest in the seemingly endless series of mass shootings plaguing this country. As the politically powerful shamelessly continue to make sure nothing is done, I'll have some thoughts to share on this latest tragedy at the end of today's broadcast. At the intersection of religion, government, and politics this week, in Tennessee, the state Republican Party has launched an all-out assault on the Democratic candidate for state Senate, demanding that other Democrats distance themselves from Gail Jordan. Her crime? She's an atheist. In fact, she heads the invaluable nonprofit organization Recovering from Religion. And apparently, the U.S. Constitution's explicit ban on a religious test for public office no longer applies. Meanwhile, despite widespread opposition and alarm from business and human rights groups, a so-called religious liberties bill continues to advance through the legislative process in Iowa. Friends, it's nothing less than shocking that well-meaning people of faith have been convinced nationwide that doing business with the public should never require tolerance nor compromise. From the drafting of our founding documents until just very recently, the cornerstone of our nation and our collective freedom has been finding ways to get along despite all kinds of differences. When it comes to the current assault on marriage equality, unless you're the actual celebrant, you are not blessing a marriage that you think your religion condemns. Whether the objection you have is over gender, race, age, or past marital status. But that's not going to stop the march of institutionalized bigotry in Iowa and the tears in the fabric of our society, tears that will hurt every last one of us, will continue to grow. And lastly, the political religious right hit yet another new low this week. Emboldened, empowered, and enabled by the Trump administration, the multimillion-dollar hate group Family Research Council, which has built its influential empire by relentlessly fear-mongering among its generous but gullible supporters, still recognized as a tax-deductible educational charity organization, sent out a fundraising letter directly targeting another nonprofit. Tony Perkins wants $200,000 to take down the Southern Poverty Law Center. You heard me right. Not content with relentlessly spreading misinformation about reproductive rights and LGBTQ sexuality, with parroting the most divisive GOP talking points, with giving purportedly faith-based cover for the president, FRC now wants its Christian conservative supporters to throw almost $250,000 their way just to facilitate Tony Perkins' long-hungered-for revenge on an iconic American institution simply for correctly branding FRC a hate group. And of course, all of it in the name of Jesus. Now, here's what's coming up this week on State of Belief Radio.
A former leader of the American Nazi Party is running for Congress in Illinois. As the only Republican on the ticket, it looks like he is about to win the primary next month.
I don't call myself a Nazi. I call myself an American patriot and statesman.
We told you last week about this notorious Nazi who's running for a Senate seat from Illinois. His name is Arthur Jones, and his candidacy as a Republican helped prompt the recent Religion Dispatch's article headlined, "All of a Sudden, There's Nazis Everywhere, and They Only Seem to Associate with One Party." Later in the hour, I'll welcome the author, Reverend Dan Schultz, back to State of Belief Radio.
One reason why the welfare system is out of control is because we have a massive illegitimate welfare birth rate in this country. I mean, they're literally breeding faster than they can raise your taxes to pay for them.
Of course, this is nothing new. I'm fortunate to be speaking to you from Louisiana, which has a proud heritage of voting for hate mongers and outright kooks over the years. We'll look at some of those with University of Louisiana political science professor Pearson Cross. But first,
statistics that show that this Generation Z is now becoming, well, they're people with no faith. They're becoming atheists.
For several years now, various polls have shown the significant growth in the percentage of Americans who consider themselves nuns, the religiously unaffiliated, fast-growing group. Often, pollsters conflate atheists with the spiritual but not religious in this cohort, which leaves lots of wiggle room for those who are eager to deny or diminish this trend. Such is not the case with recent findings among the country's Generation Z, born between 1999 and 2015. The respected Barna Group found a breathtaking spike in overt atheist identity among what the researchers call our first post-Christian generation. And I am pleased to welcome Barna Senior Vice President of Research, Brooke Hempbell, to State of Belief Radio. Brooke, welcome.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having me.
How does Gen Z break down among lines of religious affiliation?
They are the least Christian of any generation that we've seen, for sure. Gen Z has 34% who would consider themselves or their religious affiliation to be atheist, agnostic, or none. And that none is increasingly a common answer when we ask people about their religious affiliation. But also that there are a portion who still consider themselves Christian. We've got 4% who we would say have a biblical worldview, who kind of ascribe to a number of theologically conservative perspectives. And they would kind of share some views that suggest that they are really engaged in their faith. Their faith really matters to them. And that they have some beliefs that we would consider, you know, genuinely Christian. Mm-hmm. So that's a big difference from the rest of the country. If you look at the national averages, this is historically a Christian nation. So we have a much broader proportion of the general adult population who would consider themselves Christian. In 2016, our latest kind of tracking of spiritual metrics that we've looked at for over 30 years, we had a total population of 19% saying atheist, agnostic, and none, compared to those 34% of Gen Z. And then we had a small proportion that we call evangelical. That's kind of like that biblical worldview amongst the teens. That's 6%. 8% another faith, and 28% who would say, "I'm born again, right? I believe in Jesus, and I have a commitment to Jesus," and 39% all other Christians. So it's a really different proportion for Gen Z, and they've really ratcheted up in that atheist, agnostic, and none. And as you mentioned, the atheist group in particular is what surprised us, that it has doubled compared to other generations.
The 13% number in your findings, Is that comprised of overtly atheist people?
That is people who we said, what is your religious affiliation? They selected the box atheist.
I'm wondering whether that figure is higher than most of us would expect, not so much because there are more atheists, but because there is more liberty in saying what you want to say about yourself, and they're saying atheists.
Yeah, it's interesting. We actually have had other people ask us, you know, if we went back and looked at our atheist data in previous generations, do we think that there's evidence that those people who didn't say that they were atheists but didn't say Christian actually might have been atheists? Or there might have even been, you know, self-professed Christians who were atheists based on what they say their beliefs were. I think that's true. I would actually say it's just a general shift in the acceptability of atheism. So one of the things we see most highly correlated with atheism is people's perspective on science. And this generation, more than any before them, really highly esteems science and its impact on their beliefs. And they often see that in conflict with the Bible or with Christianity. And so they're more willing to ascribe to something they feel is concrete. And that's where this atheism becomes more palatable.
Do you have any concerns that the respondents in this cohort are so young, with the oldest being just 19?
Of course. So this is the first peak at this generation. They will change. We often wait to even define a generation until they hit their late teens, early 20s. So their perspectives will shift as they go off to college and they experience some life events for sure.
So were you surprised when you put these numbers side by side how this generation compares with other age groups that Barna looked at?
Not totally surprised. I think our anecdotal evidence was borne out in the data, kind of what we see and observe about today's teens. We're not totally surprised about their religious affiliation. We've seen a slide in affiliation with various Christian denominations. We've seen a slide in affiliation with Jesus. And the surprise here was the atheism, because we have seen a growth in the, quote, nuns. But this was a doubling of atheism, which happened very dramatically. And that was what was a surprise. So again, like you said, I think a lot of it has to do with that being a more acceptable answer. And also just in general, I think they're not willing to ascribe to Christianity yet. They want to feel more confident that it's true. So whereas in the past, the default might have been, well, I'm going to say I'm Christian because that's how I grew up until proved otherwise. Now it's, well, I'm not going to say I have a belief in any sort of God until I can prove Christianity. So it's kind of an inverse perspective. That's not particularly surprising to us, but the numbers were more dramatic than we expected.
We often hear this argument that young people are less religious, but as they get older, that changes. So let me ask you this. Are you able to look at, say, members of Generation X or Generation Y and what their responses were to these questions back when they were as young as Generation Z is today?
So we have started to do that for millennials and Gen X, for sure. It is true that when you hit certain life stages, there is more interest in church and in Christianity, and you have more spiritual questions. The numbers returning are not as significant as those leaving. And in particular, one of the biggest factors is that those life stages are delayed. So in the baby boomer generation and the elder generation, people got married and had children a lot younger. And now that's like 10 years delayed in a millennial generation. So they're not going to be ready to have those spiritual conversations or questions for 10 more years. That means that their affiliations for things other than Christianity grow during that time.
So what does all of this tell us about the likely impact of religion in America over the next 10 or 20 years?
Yeah, that's a guessing game. If we follow the current trends, there would be a super quick decline. And the rise of the nuns has been very steep. I also look at this data and honestly have to say that trajectory, it would be highly unlikely that trajectory would continue quite as steep as it has without a correction. Here's where we base this evidence on. We've looked at other post-Christian countries, and basically that's in Europe. And we've done some studies in England and in Scotland and Ireland very recently that are very much post-Christian nations in the way that they practice. And what we're seeing is the pendulum beginning to swing back, because there's a great deal of void that young people are expressing. And they're suddenly taking interest in things that they weren't before in terms of church or community or social justice, a number of kind of factors that fit along with ministry. And so while we do think that these trends are real, we do anticipate that the pendulum will begin to swing back at a certain point, because we've seen that evidence in Europe.
I'm also interested in what kind of response you're getting to the release of these figures.
It's been really interesting. In fact, many people have picked up on the atheism stats, and that's been a big question because we did present it as, hey, it doubled. So that's been obviously quite a headline for many people. But there's also been some really positive responses. I must admit that having worked on this study for over a year and a half, my blood pressure began to rise as I saw some of the impacts on this generation, partially what's happening to them as much as what they are believing and doing in terms of technology and social media and how that's impacting their experience. But the positive side, the flip side of that is two things. One is there's a bit of a blank slate. There's not the same kind of baggage and harm from past experiences. You know, there's an opportunity for religion to start over and come in with fresh relevance to them. And the other is that faith holds the answers to a lot of questions and a lot of needs that these teens have. So some of the major topics that arose that were of significant concern were anxiety. There's kind of fear and anxiety about the future and about one's identity, and confusion, not knowing what truth is, and not really being certain if there is such a thing as truth, not knowing that you have importance in your life, not knowing that you make a difference in the world. And all those things are things to which there are answers in religion and in faith. And so we are really optimistic, and the response has been really optimistic from people in youth ministry and another area of church that have said, this is great. I mean, it's really awful, some of the experiences that teens are having right now. But at the same time, we have an opportunity to be genuinely helpful to them.
Is there anything we haven't talked about that is important that you need to talk about?
I do want to mention, you know, I kind of alluded to some of the challenges with this generation and technology, social media, and anxiety. Those are real. I really want to emphasize this. One of the reactions we got to the study was we heard from a lot of youth leaders who said, I have seen a dramatic spike in anxiety and self-harm amongst the teens that I interact with. And that is real. There are a lot of statistics about the rise in that. And I really encourage youth leaders or those in ministry to be familiar with those issues, to become really versed and knowledgeable about what to do and how to respond and how to genuinely empathize and also seek help, because there's a need for intervention. And again, I feel like the church offers a great response, but at the same time, leaders have to be equipped to be ready to help students and to take those needs seriously. So that's, to me, really a call to action, is to be aware of mental health and to be proactive about that.
Brooke Hempel is Senior Vice President of Research at Barna Research. The new report, Atheism Doubles Among Generation Z, is available online at barna.com. I encourage you to go and take a look there. Brooke, thank you for taking the time to be with us today and to be so informative. We're glad to have you on State of Belief Radio.
Great. You're welcome. Thank you. Great questions.
There's lots more still to come on this week's show. The Reverend Dan Schultz will explain his provocative article headlined, All of a Sudden, There's Nazis Everywhere, and They Only Seem to Associate with One Party. And for some historical context, we'll turn to University of Louisiana's political science professor, Pearson Cross. If you miss any part of today's show, You can hear full episodes of State of Belief anytime on our website. You'll also find links to the topics we discussed this week, extended interviews and transcripts, and an archive of past shows. All of that at stateofbelief.com. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, religion and radio done differently. All of a sudden, there's Nazis everywhere, and they only seem to associate with one party. That's the headline of a recent Religion Dispatches article. The author is Pastor Dan Schultz, and I am pleased to welcome Dan back to our show. Dan, thanks for being with us again on State of Belief.
Always a pleasure, Welton.
We mentioned Arthur Jones briefly on the show last week. Mm-hmm. So who is this guy?
He is the former head of the American Nazi Party. He is an actual Nazi. He is also running for Congress in the 3rd District of Illinois. He seems to be a perennial candidate, and recently he's chosen to run there against Dan Lipinski. What seems to be going on here, this district is a safe, democratic district, which is how Jones got in the first place. No Republican wanted to take on Lipinski, and so he sort of slipped in the back door over the objections of the Illinois GOP. Hmm. While a safe, democratic district, it is a culturally conservative one with many Italian, Irish, Czech immigrants. So he has an opportunity here to embarrass the GOP and get attention for his neo-Nazi views. Mm-hmm. So that's probably what he's up to rather than making a serious attempt to get into Congress.
I see. Well, one candidate doesn't a pattern make. Are you seeing this phenomena playing out in other places?
The one that I'm aware of off the top of my head is Paul Nealon, who is challenging Paul Ryan in Wisconsin's 1st District, trying to run in the primary. Interestingly enough, Arthur Jones is from Beloit and went to college in Whitewater, which are both represented in Ryan's district. So he and Nealon are from the same area in southern Wisconsin. And like Jones, Nealon was rejected by the Wisconsin GOP, although belatedly. And I should say in their defense that in Wisconsin, you don't need party authorization to put yourself on the ticket. If you get the signatures, you can run as a Republican, whether or not the Republicans want you. Okay. Still, this is a guy who got 10,000 votes against Ryan in 2016 and had the support of no less than Donald Trump when he felt like bullying Paul Ryan. You know, that's two candidates, but that's too many.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We both know full well that this kind of language gets called out all the time. You're equating Nazis with patriotic salt of the earth Americans who happen to be Republicans, they'll howl. But why is writing about this connection so offensive when the actual candidates apparently aren't?
That is a very good question, and I'm glad you asked it. I don't really have an answer. You would think that in America, in the year of our Lord, 2018, there's nothing really more difficult than saying Nazis should be rejected. Perhaps the only easier thing to say would be that children shouldn't be slaughtered with AR-15s. Mm. But as we know, that seems to be too hard for the Republicans, too.
Mm. To what do you attribute these candidates coming out of the woodwork?
There's two things here. One is that Trump has pretty clearly identified himself tacitly, if not overtly, with the white nationalist movement. He's their guy, and they know it. And so they feel emboldened to come out of the woodwork and try to agitate for their views. Now, you know, don't get me wrong, Nazis aren't going to take over the U.S. anytime soon, but they are inching ever closer to the mainstream, and every time they do that, they pick up a little more support and a little more support. And it doesn't take a lot of support to cause big problems. But the other thing that we have to realize is that this comes out of a long history of the GOP playing footsie with racist and religious bigots. Steve Bannon, the advisor to Donald Trump before he was fired, ran Breitbart, which had still has to this day a section on black crime, and has a long history of making racist and anti-Semitic remarks. That's who our president chooses to associate with, but these people have been in and around Republican circles for 50 years, and they just keep getting closer and closer to the mainstream of that party. That's a problem.
Does Donald Trump know what he's doing? Does he know what he's doing in relation to this Nazi buildup and those positive reactions to his hate?
I sincerely believe that he's not interested in building up the movement in any kind of formal sense. Mm-hmm. My hunch is that he agrees with those views, and so he finds it very difficult to reject them, of course, mm-hmm. or to come out four square against them. And so he's lending this almost unintentional kind of support to them. He doesn't really care if they get bigger. He doesn't really care if they get smaller. As always, it's about Trump and his ideas about what's going on in the world.
Yeah, I understand. In the election cycle, will Ryan take this guy on as a legitimate candidate, or will he attack the Nazism, or how will he handle that?
He will try to ignore him as much as he can, because he risks being perceived as punching down, and so he'll give him an unfair platform if he takes him on too directly. Mm-hmm. The Wisconsin GOP, as I say, has rejected Nealon, and so Ryan will use that to say, no, this guy is not a Republican, he's not even a true conservative, the tax cuts are working. I mean, that's Ryan's mantra all the time.
Sure.
Tax cuts are working. Now we need to get spending in order to promote economic growth.
Why do you think there's not a more concerted effort from within the party, including the political religious right, to push back against these kinds of candidates? Because even if morality doesn't force them to step up, you would think that they wouldn't want to be associated with this kind of hate. Or are we simply too far into the shameless age that doesn't seem to make any difference?
Let me introduce what might be a kind of artificial distinction here, okay. Particularly in the minds of any minority listeners that you might have. There's a difference between white supremacy, which is the racist systems that keep whites on top of society, and white nationalism, which would be outright bigotry, hate, mm-hmm. And violence. The Republicans' dilemma is that they have become the party of whites, the party of white supremacy, the party that works to keep whites on top of the society. If they acknowledge that, if they embrace the white nationalism, they're going to get creamed. Mm-hmm. So they have to find ways to do that work quietly, without attracting too much attention. And so they have to do this very delicate dance of rejecting Paul, Nealon, and Arthur Jones without ticking off their sort of more mildly racist supporters.
But they want the votes.
They want the votes. They don't want the votes of the Nazis because the Nazis aren't very big. But they want the votes of those people who are not willing to question how the society works or how it keeps blacks and other minorities at the bottom of the pile.
Dan, what else should our listeners keep in mind as they watch all of this playing out?
Well, as I suggested in the article, right at the top of the list should be, if you're not a Nazi, don't vote for the Nazi. Doesn't matter how much you dislike other leaders, don't go for that kind of alternative. I mean, it sounds absolutely insane to have to give that kind of advice, but people need to hear it. The other thing that they need to keep in mind is that they have a responsibility to vote. The way Paul Nealon got into the race against Ryan, the way Arthur Jones got into the race in Illinois 3rd District, is that a very, very small number of people can affect the outcome of primary races. So if you don't want to see Nazis running for political office, get in there, support your candidate. Make sure that they have the nominations and the votes they need. And if need be, you run for office, too, to keep somebody like that out.
Good advice. Pastor Dan Schultz is a minister in the United Church of Christ. He serves a small and very patient congregation in Wisconsin and writes provocatively and articulately when the Spirit moves him. His Religion Dispatches article is headlined, "All of a Sudden, There's Nazis Everywhere, and They Only Seem to Associate with One Party." We'll link to that from stateofbelief.com. Dan, it is always good to talk with you again. Thanks so much for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you very much, Walton. I appreciate it.
Unfortunately, my home state of Louisiana has a particularly colorful and at times shameful history of fringe political candidates. After all, this is where white supremacist David Duke was elected to the State House of Representatives, and there have been plenty of others. For some historical context around this newly urgent issue, I'm joined by Dr. Pearson Cross, professor of political science at the University of Louisiana at Lafayette. Pearson, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thanks, Walton. Good to be here.
Is David Duke the best, or I should say worst, poster child for extremist political candidates in Louisiana and beyond, or are there others that are less notorious but perhaps even more hateful than come to mind?
Well, I don't know about any more hateful, but there's certainly many that are less notorious. I mean, David Duke has the notoriety that comes with being a former Grand Dragon and Senate candidate and, you know, nearly successful gubernatorial candidate and a longtime fixture on the Nazi scene, so to speak. But there's certainly many others that are equally equally notorious.
What can we identify about the kinds of campaigns that work for candidates like this?
Well, right now that it's, you know, back in style to be nativist, to be anti-immigrant, to be anti-elite, to be anti-Jewish, to be anti-woman, to be pro, you know, kind of overt masculine displays. I mean, we're seeing all that. And those are the kind of things that really bring out the nativists, the homegrown nativists, but also the fringe elements like the Nazis and the white supremacists.
Are you seeing in your work more and more of this?
Oh, absolutely. There's a real resurgence on the far right in American life. And frankly, it's attributable to Donald Trump's, you know, election as president and some of the themes he ran on. He's extremely overt. He's certain no one would accuse Donald Trump of being subtle. You know, so he comes out and Mexicans are rapists and murderers and talking about the very fine people who marched in Charlottesville. And it's a wink-wink nod that we're very used to by people who make these kind of appeals. You know, he recently said he would rather have Norwegian immigrants, you know, rather than any other kind. And these are signals that are heard by the alt-right in America.
At one time, we would have said that the religious right, among other things, is a group of fundamentalist Christians. So how in the world do they rub shoulders with these people that we're seeing step forward now?
When you say religious right, you're really saying the white religious right more than anything else. And there's a real sense there that they've taken on the paranoia of the Nazi organization, the idea that the government is out to get them and that there's an effort made to repress them, to deny them their rights, to suppress them. You know, they see themselves as the true Americans, the Americans like the Americans that founded our country, white Protestant Americans. So they interpret the movement of the federal government in particular as against them, which puts them very much in the same camp as those people who are not religious, but who also see the federal government and inclusion and equality and equal rights for other people as a threat. So they've kind of ended up on the same boat, frankly.
Pearson, is there a real risk to not taking fringe candidates seriously enough, and by that I mean on the part of both opponents and of the political party that they might lay claim to?
Oh, well, absolutely. And I think the biggest illustration is Donald Trump. Donald Trump is a fringe candidate who captured a vocal but clear minority in the Republican Party. I mean, Donald Trump was not, if you took everyone else, you know, in terms of who their support was for, he was not the majority candidate. He was a minority candidate, but he was very vocal. He was aggressive. He motivated a particular swipe, and he was elected. And that indicates that for people on the right, you know, they can at times leverage that support, that very vocal, powerful support that they have into getting nominated. And we saw that with Arthur Jones, right, the candidate who it looks like is going to get the Republican nomination for Congress in Illinois.
I think there are mixed reasons that extremists have managed to win elections in Louisiana historically, including the noble principle of open-mindedness. But that inevitably has also drawn some real monsters. Are there other candidates or politicians that we should mention?
Well, you know, this is the thing about drawing distinction. So you have somebody like from Shreveport, Mike Johnson, the congressman up there. Now, he's very, very conservative. He's a religious conservative. He's authored some legislation when he was in the House here that seemed to want to roll back the rights of LGBT people. And he really just aligned himself very strongly with a Christian conservative movement. Now, so you take a person like that and you say, well, okay, I haven't seen anything that reads white supremacist there, but you just don't know. I mean, maybe there hasn't been that opportunity for him to, you know, kind of continue on in that direction. So you're just not sure. You know, there's some people who are very, very conservative.
Do you have any people in mind that we should be keeping our eyes on?
Down here, you also get the real religious mix as well. You know, certainly the congressman in the 3rd District, in my district, Clay Higgins, who has kind of made a fetish of God, guts, and guns. He routinely goes to his meetings with a open carry gun strapped on, despite the fact that he's no longer in law enforcement, wears jeans and a hat, takes videos with him with an automatic weapon, talking about meeting thugs. I mean, that's the kind of rhetoric that usually precedes a bloodbath. So it's completely unseemly for a U.S. congressman to engage in that kind of rhetoric and to promulgate those kind of images. So certainly Clay Higgins is one. Other ones I pointed to, Mike Johnson. Everybody else is, for what it, all intents and purposes at the congressional level, I think, you know, what was widely considered mainstream, although very conservative. You know, it was the first district in Louisiana that, in that area over there, the extremely white suburbs of New Orleans that elected David Duke.
Right.
You know, so there's this, and now that's the area that Steve Scalise, number three in the United States Congress, represents.
Yeah.
So you really get a sense that there's no penalty in these districts in Louisiana for being more conservative than the next person, and even, you know, where that takes you in terms of racial terms.
Mm-hmm. Some people would say, we've already said this ourselves, that our current president fits the model of a candidate that personifies the anger and defiance of his or her supporters. Put that in historical perspective, Pearson. Is what we're seeing with the current president, is there any place in history that comes close to what he is and what he's doing?
Well, not since the the early 20th century. I mean, Woodrow Wilson, I'm thinking, was kind of reactionary and moved to the United States back. I mean, when I think of Donald Trump, I think of Andrew Jackson, but in the non-heroic sense, right?
Yeah.
Andrew Jackson didn't have bone spurs, apparently, and actually engaged in some battles that were, important and monumental. But that's the kind of rhetoric that Andrew Jackson certainly, was thought America for white Christian Americans, and the Indians could get the hell out, there are no modern comparisons for people that were actually elected. You know, somebody said recently that we've never had a president who had this kind of outlook before. There have been congressmen, there have been people who were elected at state levels, certainly all the segregationists in the mm-hmm. South. But to have a president who is this far out of the mainstream in terms of racial, ethnic views, view of America's role in the world, is quite frankly, it's unprecedented.
Pearson, I think it's not inaccurate to say that we're seeing some more fringe-type figures rising to power in other parts of the world as well. Do you have any thoughts about the reason for this pattern?
Yeah, that's something I've been wondering about a little bit myself. You know, obviously we're familiar with Brexit, but we're also looking at Turkey. We're looking at the rise of the strong men around the world, the Putins and so on. And, the only thing I can think of is that America is shrinking from its historic leadership role. You know, I think we took our foot off the gas a little bit in terms of our leadership. When I think partly that was because there was such a push in the United States to undercut Obama and the Obama government's administration's initiatives. You know, the Republican Party identified Obama as the enemy, mm-hmm. and hence, they didn't support him in some ways internationally. Also, George Bush, we spent a lot of our energies blowing places up, invading, and that doesn't help us around the world, And so the world is a stranger and more dangerous place now, it feels. So that's the only thing that I can really say right now is that we have a changing world environment where it looks like the strong men, the kind of Mussolini kind of national characters, which is where I place Trump, are rising and claiming their moment for national greatness in all these separate places. It does not bode well for the future.
Yeah, that's... And I was thinking as you're talking, not only does it not bode well for the future, it's going to take a long time to get over what's going on right now.
Well, not only on the international sphere. I mean, the damage that's being done to the accords, and the agreements, the abdication of American leadership in Asia and elsewhere. China, is loving this. They're moving to the fore. Mm-hmm. It's really going to take a long time. But, of course, the courts are being filled now at full speed. So you really have to say, how duplicitous can you get? Let's do the super slow on Obama's appointments, but the super fast on Trump's.
Yeah.
And some of the people that are going in there, clearly unqualified, they're going to be there for, 40 years? This is really a disaster. Trump's presidency, in my view, has been a disaster on a number of levels. And those are two of them, certainly.
Pearson, I've got to ask this question. Is there anything that gives you hope that we might retreat from this kind of extremism, or to put it another way, have we seen that trends like this tend to be cyclical in the past?
Yeah, I do have hope. I mean, I think demographically we're past the point where we as a country can do this. And I think in the past, if you look at McCarthy, as damaging as that was with the red baiting and the blacklists and all that, finally there was a moment where people just had had enough and were repulsed and by the whole spectacle. And the thing about this is that I think the people who are pushing this are going to overreach, and we are going to be repulsed by what they've done. And we're seeing that, certainly in terms of the Me Too movement. I think that's partially energized by people who are repulsed that Donald Trump is clearly, a serial abuser and is now in the highest office in the country. And so I think there's a grassroots movement to install decency and to welcome and to say that's not us. And so that gives me hope.
Dr. Pearson Cross is Associate Professor of Political Science and Associate Dean of the College of Liberal Arts at the University of Louisiana at Lafayette, where he hosts the weekly radio program Bayou to Beltway on KRVS Radio. Pearson is a good personal friend for many years and still is, but I really appreciate you bringing your expertise to this discussion. You enlighten us. Sometimes you shock us. You keep us tied to reality. And I can't thank you enough for doing that. We always want you on State of Belief Radio.
Well, thank you so much. That's awfully nice to say. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, before we go, last Wednesday, an ancient Hebrew prophet gave me the only words that I felt like saying. How long, O God, how long? The day had felt strange already. Ash Wednesday and Valentine's Day. As a Christian, I felt the somberness of the entrance to the season of Lent. As an American, I felt the warmth and joy of Valentine's Day with its affirmation of love and encouragement to express that love we have for other people or for just one special person. Then came breaking news. Another episode of gun violence in a school. The news got worse. A large number of school students and teachers had been hurt, and 17 people were dead. While 17 innocent people were where they were supposed to be, doing what they were supposed to be doing, they lost their lives because someone had ready access to a gun. Ash Wednesday, Valentine's Day, gun violence, unjust hurts, innocent deaths, gun violence. None of that goes together. How long, O God, how long? My reaction to what should not have happened, to what did not have to happen, was different this time. Different from what other episodes of gun violence have evoked within me. After Sandy Hook and the massacre of children that happened there, I wept and grieved. I even thought to myself that this would be a turning point and reform in gun laws would take place. But since then, nearly 2,000 more people have died from gun violence, more children as well as adults. This time, I felt the rawest kind of anger. I was furious. I was mad. I still am. I don't want to hear the worn-out phrases that always get repeated by people who speak of their thoughts and prayers for the families of those who needlessly lost loved ones in a rain of bullets. I don't want to hear that we need to do more about mental health as a way of stopping gun violence when we are giving everybody easy access to guns. I don't want to be told again that the best remedy for stopping gun violence is to arm more people with guns. Please, please, I don't want to hear even one more time someone say we shouldn't talk about gun laws until people are through grieving this most recent mass killing. How long, O God? How long? Our nation has spoken on this matter repeatedly, unambiguously, and potently. Only very few people oppose helpful reforms in gun laws. But Congress turns its back and does not pay attention to the public's will. Patriots of our nation feel no pride in the fact that only in the USA do such horrible mass shootings continue to happen. Congress and President Trump have blood on their hands. These are people who can affect major change for the better without violating the Second Amendment to the Constitution. The president praises the NRA and boasts about his support for guns. Members of Congress have the power to change the gun violence that continues to strike our nation, but does nothing. When will members of Congress start refusing money from the gun lobby and start returning their campaign contributions from the NRA? How long, O God, how long? But of course, this is not a God issue. This is a human issue of bravado and selfishness, in which money is more powerful than compassion, and guns and more powerful guns are more important than people's lives. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want to say a sincere thank you. If you think there's value in the conversations we present and the voices we amplify in the midst of the gridlock our public rhetoric too often becomes, please make your contribution today. Find more information at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcasts on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter and engage in the discussion. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to tune in next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
It's time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going on.